Welcome to the Community Oncology Journal podcast for the month of September 2011. I'm Dr. David Henry. This month we have articles on the wearable external cardiac defibrillator in cancer patients, not to be confused with the implantable cardiac defibrillator, for patients at risk of sudden death. We review the quality care initiative across the country in oncology and how it needs to be a team effort, followed by 10 tips for implementing quality improvement in your practice. We have a case report of an acute megakaryoblastic leukemia, which had an unusual vaginal myeloid granulocytic sarcoma lesion, and a case report of a mandibular fracture in a patient on both bevacizumab and bisphosphonate therapy. We visit again the direct-to-consumer genetic testing and its impact on patient care, and how the Medicare Shared Savings Program ignores oncology, for which you should actually consider yourself lucky. And our practical biostatisticians review a glioblastoma trial and how you should keep a high index of suspicion before you put your confidence in surrogate endpoints. So let's begin. The Wearable External Cardiac Defibrillator for Cancer Patients at Risk for Sudden Death by Dr. Melanie Everett and colleagues from the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah. In a retrospective study, these authors examined 23,797 patients who were prescribed a wearable cardiac defibrillator. 0.02%, or 59 of them, had cancer. The indication for the defibrillator was poor ventricular function in most patients, and 5 had prior life-threatening arrhythmias. An implanted cardiac defibrillator was removed in 6 of the 59 due to infection or thrombus. Successful shocks were delivered on 5 occasions to 4 of the 59 within 3 months. 11 patients died, but none of these deaths was due to noncompliance or failure of the defibrillator device. Contraindications to an implantable cardiac defibrillator are life expectancy less than 1 year, incessant arrhythmia, psychiatric illness, and syncope without ventricular arrhythmia, just to name a few. This retrospective study underlines that even our cancer patients can benefit greatly from the wearable external cardiac defibrillator and use it successfully for the usual indications. Next, quality care is a team effort by our co-editor, Dr. Linda Bosserman from the Wilshire Oncology Medical Group in Laverne, California. The Institute of Medicine defines quality of healthcare as, quote, the degree to which health services for individuals and populations increase the likelihood of desired health outcomes and are consistent with current professional knowledge, unquote. All of us strive to deliver quality oncology care and improve it whenever possible, but then, as Dr. Alan Lichter has said, quote, you cannot improve which you do not measure, unquote. So how should we go about documenting what we do so that we can measure it and improve? Let's start with the back office staff. Initial and follow-up intake by support staff should gather referral information and documentation of medications and comorbid illnesses along with demographic data. At a subsequent visit, the medical assistants should review this information and document what has changed for the electronic record. Mid-level practitioners then take this information and review it, confirm it, and explore the patient's symptoms and treatment plan, followed by the physician who uses his expertise to continue the patient's treatment and or diagnosis. It is crucial for our patients to be engaged in this process and their care and treatment plan from the beginning to the end. Standardized forms and or computer tablets can guide patients reporting on their key toxicities, medication compliance, interval care, and any new concerns they might have. Our administrative staff is responsible for collecting all this information and providing a usable, specific, and summary format for the entire team to review and measure so as to improve and deliver quality care. Increasingly, the payers want to see this process implemented and review it in de-identified fashion so they can see if the care their patients are getting is both documented high quality and shows improvement where necessary. The physician practice will benefit because it delivers not only better care, but it can evaluate where costs are appropriate or need to be addressed along the way in this process. A companion article by Dr. Alan Lichter from the American Society of Clinical Oncology is entitled 10 Tips for Implementing Quality Improvement in Your Practice. First, do not self-define quality. It is not just quote, you know it when you see it, unquote. There are definite metrics and measurements essential to assess quality care, and here are a few of them. Measure and compare your data. Consider the return on this investment. Identify and remove unwanted variation in your care delivery. Continue to enhance standard of care and innovation. Remember that cost does matter. Underline that we need to learn how to improve, meaning constantly look for techniques to update or improve your care consistent with national guidelines. Create a learning and improvement culture at every level in your practice. Automate this whenever possible. Let your voice be heard. We should all get involved with our national organizations and payers at the national and local level to continue to enhance this process wherever possible. Now on to a case report entitled Acute Megakaryoblastic Leukemia with an Associated Vaginal Myeloid Sarcoma by Dr. Bradley Lash and colleagues from the Lankenau Medical Center in Wynwood, Pennsylvania. A 62-year-old woman presented to the emergency room with a 2-day complaint of sore throat and abdominal pain. 2 months earlier, she was diagnosed with acute megakaryoblastic leukemia. CAT scan at presentation now revealed organomegaly but no abnormality in the pelvis, but a pelvic exam revealed a 4-centimeter vaginal mass along the posterior vaginal wall that was biopsied and found to be a granulocytic myeloid sarcoma from her acute megakaryoblastic leukemia. Another case report is entitled Mandibular Fracture in a Patient Treated with Long-Term Anti-Angiogenic Therapy and Previous Bisphosphonate Exposure by Dr. Tyler Davis and colleagues from the Indiana University, Indianapolis, Indiana. Very few of us have not heard of the bisphosphonate association with osteonecrosis of the jaw, or ONJ, and the brittle bone syndrome, but now there is a concern that anti-angiogenic therapy with drugs like bevacizumab could also contribute to ONJ and or brittle bones. This patient had a jaw fracture and a previous history of ONJ, yet this jaw fracture occurred despite discontinuing bisphosphonates for some time. This raises the concern for the VEGF or VEGF blockade therapy contributing to bone weakness, bone fracture, and ONJ, as has previously been reported. So we should watch for this going forward. Next, direct-to-consumer genetic testing has potential impact on patient care. What oncologists need to know by Dr. Stacy Gray at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. There are several fast facts that you need to know about direct-to-consumer, or DTC, genetic testing. Did you know that more than 98% of genetic tests are sold as, quote, homebrew tests, unquote, and are not subject to FDA review? Furthermore, marketing materials from DTC genetic testing companies are generally not reviewed by the FTC, Federal Trade Commission. Nearly 74% of people who are considering testing but who have been tested cite their desire to gain knowledge about diseases that run in their family. Thus far, the early adopters of DTC genetic testing tend to be predominantly white, well-educated, and wealthy. And finally, early evidence suggests that the results of these DTC tests may be leading consumers to make changes in their health-related behaviors, but have these patients been properly counseled? Often not. Many times, these tests are performed without the input of a professional at all. Next, Medicare Shared Savings Program ignores oncology, but value-based reimbursement is on the way by Matthew Bro at McKesson Specialty Healthcare in Washington, D.C. The Medicare Shared Savings Program, or MSSP, will likely be a non-event for oncology. Have you heard about the ACO, or the Accountable Care Organization? Well, that was part of the 2010 Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and was supposed to create integrated delivery systems in geographic areas and require oncology to see that they form their own ACOs and or figure out how to plug into established ones. However, this will not be the case since CMS does not intend for the shared savings program to tackle cost effectiveness in the oncology setting, probably for the following reasons. Oncology managed patients are not considered in the MSSP and would not be assigned to an ACO. Even if oncologist-managed patients were included in the MSSP, they will still likely be excluded by the outlier threshold rule because their treatment and management costs are so high. So the good news is that this complicated, untried, and burdensome system driving many to form ACOs, will largely skip us in the community oncology setting. Mercifully, I might add. Counting what really counts. The irinotecan and recurrent glioblastoma trial by Drs. Striner and Norman from Ontario, Canada. A phase 2 trial was reported in the Journal of Clinical Oncology in 2009, in which 167 glioma patients experienced their first or second relapse. They received either bevacizumab alone or bevacizumab in combination with irinotecan. The study stated at the outset that this was a non-comparative trial, yet the study also reported a significant difference in median survival of 4.2 versus 6.6 months in favor of the combination therapy. Our statisticians dissect this trial and beg to differ. The survival cut point was at 6 months follow-up, yet a shift slightly in either direction, less than or greater than 6 months cut point, would make what appears to be a significant difference go away, supporting what the study author said at the outset of their article, that this was a non-comparative trial and no comparative conclusions can or should be made. However, the adverse events were significantly different and much more common in the combination arm, as might be expected with irinotecan. So word to the wise, be careful about significance conclusions in phase 2 studies, especially those that tell you that they are a non-comparative trial. Guiding your patients through the Internet Cancer Information by John Fried in our technology section. Have you walked into a patient room lately and seen your patient either on the laptop or on the cell phone checking information about his own or his relative's cancer care? Not yet. Well, you will. Of course, an educated consumer is a better one, and this information technology age has been a great help for our patients. But our technology piece this month offers 9 golden rules for evaluating medical websites that will help you help your patients. Rule number 1 is it is okay to trust the establishment. Sites sponsored by the American Cancer Society or the NIH are well done and reliable. Rule number 2 says it is all about us. When you add a link or review a site on the web, you can go to something on that link called, quote, about us, unquote. This will tell you who is supporting the site and help you evaluate its reliability. Make sure that information is up to date. Dates of articles, columns, videos, and podcasts are always clearly marked on the website and need to be current. Check the credentials. Who is giving the information on the website? Follow the money is the next rule. Does the website clearly state who is behind the scientists or doctors expressing their views, and do they have a financial interest in this site? Check out where the site is based. If the site is based in a foreign country, information may only pertain to patients being treated in that country and not in the U.S. Be careful about whom you talk to online. Participating in online discussions can help patients deal with cancer emotionally, but be sure whoever is moderating the session is a vetted, documented healthcare professional. Get a second opinion. When you land on a website, look for a code telling you that the website abides by the Swiss-based Health on the Net, or HON, site rules for offering medical information. You can visit this site to review it by going to www.hon.ch, where you will find additional options for finding materials from trusted sites. Finally, consult with your doctor. What a concept. If you believe in and trust your doctor, be sure and discuss information with him or her that you find on the web as well. Some sites we recommend for good, well-done cancer information for patients would be cancer.net and cancer.gov/cancer-topics. Finally, our Washington update this month is entitled FDA Skirts Esophageal Cancer Risk with Bisphosphonates, Duration of Use Takes Precedence. An FDA advisory committee on September 9, 2011, met to discuss some recent information about esophageal cancer and bisphosphonate use. The panel decided that the information was less compelling about esophageal cancer risk and did not take a stand. This was probably a reasonable viewpoint to take, as the information is still developing. Atypical fractures in ONJ from bisphosphonates were discussed, and here there was more consensus on the panel that there are issues which need to be addressed with long-term bisphosphonate use, and something already well known in the oncology treating community. And so that concludes this month's podcast for the Community Oncology Journal for the month of September 2011. We welcome your input and comments, so please visit us at our website, www.communityoncology.net. That's communityoncology.net, and thanks for listening.